This is the sixth session that we've been in the book called Song of Songs. And today we're going to start in chapter number 7, right around verse number 10. If you have any younger children around, this is PG-13 material, so you might want to get them busy elsewhere. Now, this song seems to be some sort of opera with a woman and a man and a chorus, and all of it is following their story of how they fall in love and seek relationship out in the country, and then how they eventually get married, and how most recently we were talking about how they apparently had a little bit of a tiff after they've been married for a while, and the wife is having a nightmare that results from that, and then she wakes up and she's looking for her husband and he's arriving back, and what does he do but tell her how beautiful she is and how much he loves her. And she, of course, is professing the fact that she is in love with him and he's her best friend. And there's even some very intimate talk of a sexual nature from him toward her. And she receives that as it was intended, as a desire to be intimate, since they are life partners. Because, as I keep reminding you each day that we've been studying this, the original design of God was one man, one woman together for eternity, was the original one. Then because sin and death came into the world, it was for a lifetime. And sexual activity, sexual intimacy is part of that partnership, that companionship. That goes there. And it's one of the reasons that God made us sexual beings very clearly, and how the male and female bodies correspond perfectly to one another. And the chemicals released into the blood during sexual activity bonds the couple together. So we see here at the end of this most recent scene that we are looking at, chapter 7, verse number 10, the woman sings back, "I am my beloved's, and his desire is for me." He just right before that, he had been talking about how her breasts were like clusters of dates on a palm tree, and he was going to climb up and take hold and then kiss her on her mouth and enjoy the sensation and taste of that. And she's like all on board with that now. She knows she belongs to him. He belongs to her. She is desired by him, and of course, he is desired by her. And then he says this, chapter 7, verse 11, "Come, my beloved, let's go out into the country. Let's spend the night in the villages. Let us rise early, go to the vineyards. Let us see whether the vine has budded and its blossoms have opened, and whether the pomegranates have bloomed. And there I will give you my love." So he is basically suggesting, let's patch things up completely by going away. Let's take a romantic trip. Let's go out into the country, get away from the city, be alone together, and we can reestablish our intimacy there. He even says in verse 13, "The mandrakes have given forth fragrance." Mandrakes were considered to be an aphrodisiac, not just simply the shape of the root, but the flowering of the plant itself gave a fragrance, and it was expected that this aroused the feelings of love and intimacy. He says here, "Over our doors are all choice fruits, both new and old, which I've saved up for you, my beloved." So throughout their relationship, they've focused in upon the sights and the scents that are part of their life. And here he is saying, let's take ourselves back to that fresh time of our love and our intimacy. Remember the smells and all that excitement, and because I've saved that all up for you. So he pledges this unique relationship, which is very important. Husbands and wives, once they've pledged themselves to each other, are to be only committed to one another. They have forsaken all others and sworn to become one in the sight of God and man. And so that's what he wants to go back to. Now, the woman sings something here, starting in verse 1 of chapter 8, that I think is a bit of a flashbacky sort of thing. She sings, "Oh, that you were like a brother to me, who nursed at my mother's breasts." So I think she's actually saying, "Oh, I wished I'd known you all my life." They've only met in their adulthood. Yes, it was their young adulthood. They seem to have been young people when they both came into the service of Solomon. But she wishes that it had gone back farther than that. If I found you outdoors, I would kiss you. No one would despise me either. See, brothers and sisters, they could show affection to one another, give a great big hug, even give a kiss to their brother or sister, and no one would think anything about that. And so that's what she's kind of wishing, is that, "Oh, I wished I'd had this relationship with you a long time ago, where we could have been best of friends, and no one would have thought twice about it." Verse 2, "I would lead you and bring you into the house of my mother, who used to instruct me, and I'd give you spiced wine to drink from the juices of my pomegranates." Now, there is a little bit of a strange twist there, because she's effectively saying, "I wish that you had been with me way back when we were younger, and I could have treated you like a brother out in the open, and nobody would have thought better of it." But then she suggests, "And I wished I could have brought you back to my home and made wild, passionate love to you." Because obviously she's talking to her husband. And then she sings something that we have seen a couple of different times in earlier scenes. "Let his hand be under my head and his right hand embrace me." And this is the idea of her resting her head on his left forearm as he's kind of propped up on it. And he's got his right hand free. He's kind of up and over her, and he's caressing her with his right hand, stroking her hair, stroking her face. And now that they're intimate adult husband and wife couple, no doubt stroking other parts of her body with his right hand. And she says, "I wish, I long for that sort of touch. I long for that sort of relationship." And then we close the scene, I think, in the same way we did the other scenes that had that situation of their body relationship, where she's reclined and he's caressing her. He sings out in verse 4, "I want you to swear, O daughters of Jerusalem, do not arouse or awaken my love until she pleases." So he wants her to be perfectly at peace and rest and sleep and know that she is loved and know that he is not after anyone else. She's the only one for him. She is the center of his life, the center of his world. And even if they do have little spats from time to time, he's always going to come back to her. And he should understand the same thing. And then we come, I believe, to the final scene, the seventh scene, the way that I've kind of been counting them. And I would entitle this scene "A Final Pledge of Undying Love." And I suppose not just simply the commitment sort of love, but even the passionate sort of love. The chorus kicks off this scene by singing, "Who is this coming from the wilderness, leaning on her beloved?" And so we see the woman arriving, but she's leaning comfortably upon her beloved lover from years of the past. So I think we're coming to the climax of their relationship, the maturity of their love. Then the woman sings out, "Beneath the apple tree, I awakened you." Now, we've had the talk of the apple tree several times now. It seems to be somehow related to their intimate, passionate love. Maybe even some of the kissing and petting that would go on with that. So she's basically saying our love got started and grew in the shade of the apple tree. Then she sings out something about his mom. There your mother was in labor with you. There she was in labor and gave you birth. Now that seems incongruous with what we were just talking about, unless you go with the idea of a metaphor, that just like his mom gave birth to him physically, he has been reborn by the love and passion she's poured upon him since they met. And so it's like he's a new man, reborn. Verse number 6, put me like a seal over your heart, like a seal on your arm. Now the seals that they used, some of them were cylinder seals, so it was a piece of carved material, maybe a stone. Sometimes I think they used clay that had been baked, but it had the reverse image of some sort of unique picture on the outside of this little cylinder. And you wore it on a little chain or a string around your neck. And if you needed to put your official signature on any type of document or to seal something, you would take this off and you would roll it across the clay, or they didn't use wax like this, I don't think as much, but in later times of history, any type of soft material like wax, so that it made the official image that was related to your name. So it was a way of claiming something to show that it belonged to you. So basically she's saying, let me be your seal on your heart and the seal on your arm to show that you belong to me, that we are a couple, we belong together. And then she says, for love is as strong as death. Think about that phrase for a moment. Death is a very big deal. And she says, the loving relationship of a couple is as big a deal as death itself. Jealousy is as severe as Sheol. Now, Sheol is the Hebrew word for the unseen place. It's a reference to where the spirits of the dead go and wait. At that time, they were waiting for the atonement or for judgment, depending on whether they were righteous or unrighteous. So jealousy, the idea of being concerned about a relationship being intruded upon or violated from the outside, that sort of jealousy is as serious as Sheol, as death itself. This is a bit of a parallelism here. Love and jealousy, death and Sheol. Its flashes are flashes of fire, the very flame of he who is. So lightning itself, the fire of God. That's pretty serious stuff. And so jealousy over a relationship is serious. And husbands and wives should jealously guard their relationship. Never allow it to be intruded upon by any third party. Verse 7, and it's possible that the guy may be singing this back. I'm not altogether certain. Many of the things we get because of the gender identifications given into some of the verbs and the nouns in these passages. So verse 7 might be sung by the woman as a continuation of the thought, or it might be a response from the guy. Many waters cannot quench love. See, love is a fire. It burns between a husband and a wife, and water just can't come in there and wipe it out, nor will rivers overflow it. If a man were to give all the riches of his house for love, it would be utterly despised. Meaning, money can't buy you love, if I can grab a hold of the Beatles phrase. True love is beyond cost. True love cannot be valued. There was this stupid thing that went around not too long ago, a few decades ago, I guess, where you know, a wealthy man would offer so much money to sleep with the wife of another man. And the question was, you know, kind of asked, how much money would it take for you to sleep with somebody other than your husband? And the answer biblically is, there's not enough money in the world. Because the relationship between a husband and a wife is beyond measure. And it shouldn't even enter into the mind of a person to try to put a price tag on it. And that's going to actually come up in just a moment again. Now, the chorus sings out next. We have a little sister and she has no breasts, meaning she's young, prepubescent. What shall we do for our sister on the day when she is spoken for? So now we kind of push forward into the future. What are we going to do when she does start growing up and there's interest in marrying her? Verse number 9, if she is a wall, we shall build on her a battlement of silver. Now, what seems to be communicated here is if she is very strict in her control of her body, she's not giving herself away ahead of time to any and every boy, then the family, who seems to be singing this, they're going to put a really high value upon her dowry. That is, what would be required for the groom to pay to the family on her behalf, because she will be exceptionally valuable, because she is a woman of great quality and character. And so any man that would like to spend the rest of his life with her and make her his best friend and bride should be willing to say, I'll give whatever it takes. Think about the Jacob thing, where Jacob worked 7 years in order to save up the dowry money for his beloved wife. And the scripture says that it seemed like nothing to him because she was worth it. They say, you know, if she's a wall, if she's really strong in her convictions, then we're going to put a lot of value on her marriage. But if she's a door, we will barricade her with planks of cedar. So if she's a little bit tendency to be loose, then we're going to have to step in and help deal with that. Barricade her up a little bit. Not lock her away, but rather keep a better close eye on her to make sure that she doesn't give away a very valuable thing. And that is your relationship. Your relationship that's supposed to be saved up for the man of your life, or if we flip the genders around, the woman of your life. And so this is something that has been taught in Christianity, and it was taught in Judaism before that, is that God's intention is one man, one woman together for a lifetime. Before the commitment to marriage, you remain sexually pure because you're saving that for your life's companion. And once you do get married, only for your life's companion, not to be shared with anyone else. And so that's kind of what comes out in this part of the chorus. Now, the woman sings back what type of character she had. I was a wall. So I stood strong. And my breasts were like towers. So now she kind of slides into some other things here that she matured up. And then I became in his eyes as one who finds peace. So she stayed pure. And because of that, she becomes exceptionally valued by her lover because of that commitment. And there's a play on words here that doesn't come out as clearly in the English, although most of the versions, I think, most of the translations out there put a footnote to highlight it. Then I became in his eyes as one who finds peace, which is shalom, which is related to the name Shlomo, which is Solomon, peaceful. And this is a work of art that's devoted to King Solomon, whose peaceful reign is the environment in which this story takes place. So, speaking of Solomon, the chorus chimes in with, Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Hamon. Baal was, in the time period of Solomon, a Canaanite word that was applied to he who is. It was the Canaanite equivalent of Adonai, and Adonai was a reference in Hebrew to he who is, the God of creation, the God of the Israelis. So Baal Hamon was a place that was named after God. Probably a high mountain or something like that, or a community on a hill. And so Solomon goes to this place, and he entrusted the vineyard that he had there to caretakers, and each was to bring 1,000 shekels of silver for its fruit. So they were supposed to put a high value upon the royal vineyard's production. Now, that's what the chorus sings, and it's a reference to a physical vineyard that is very expensive because it's a royal vineyard. The woman then uses that as a segue into a metaphor about her own vineyard. And you remember this from way back at the beginning of the opera, that she talked about how she grew up working in a vineyard because her big brothers made her work out there in the sun, and that's how she got all really dark-skinned and tanned. And she said at the end of that section that even though I was working in the vineyard, I wasn't taking good care of my vineyard, meaning my body. So she goes back to that metaphor here at the end of the opera. Verse 12, my very own vineyard is at my disposal. So my body is my property. I'm the one who decides who gets it. And in reference to the choral story about Solomon paying 1,000 shekels out for this vineyard, she says, the 1,000 shekels are for you, Solomon. Basically, you can keep your 1,000 shekels. You're not buying my vineyard. And 200 are for those who take care of its fruit. So even those that are getting the pay to take care of the things in between, they're not buying me. They're not buying this body. They're not going to get it because there is somebody it's being saved for. It's devoted to, and that's my husband. And that really is a good, good attitude that we need to cultivate amongst our couples and amongst those that are single and hoping one day to be married, is that their body is invaluable and it is a gift to be given to their husband or to their wife and only for them. And it doesn't matter what people might offer. Doesn't matter what type of pressure people might put on them. They shouldn't give in to it because they're worth it. They're worth saving this valuable thing for other people that mean a lot to them. The man responds to this. Verse 13, oh, you who sit in the gardens, my companions are listening for your voice. Let me hear it. So he sings back to her, oh, I've got other people. They're listening for you because they love you. They love the sound of you, but I'm the one who wants to hear from you. Say something. Speak to me. And the woman finishes the whole opera up. This is how it all wraps up. By saying something that's related to her expression of joy over seeing her beloved earlier. And this is, I think, getting back to the idea that when we're first in a relationship, when we're first married, we are much more excited and expressive, but sometimes over time we become comfortable and complacent. And what we need to do is recapture that excitement of our young love. We need to resort to the wife of our youth or the husband of our youth. I think about the book of Revelation where Jesus writes to one of the churches and tells them that, I've got this one thing against you. You've lost your first love. You've lost that passion that you used to have for me. And unless you recapture it, our relationship is over with. And so she says to him, hurry, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or a young stag on the mountains of spices. So come, be excited to come into my presence. Be excited to spend time with me. And I guess that's kind of where we ought to end our look at this operatic celebration of romantic and even intimate sexual love, is that all of us that have been married for whatever amount of time, we need to recapture that excitement of relationship. And husbands, I think maybe husbands are a little bit worse about this. When you're in the presence of your wife, make sure she knows she's appreciated. It used to be common practice. When a lady came into a room, all the gentlemen stood up. Wouldn't that be good for you as a husband to make sure you acknowledge your wife when she's coming into the room, when you're seeing her again, when you've been separated for a while, to be excited and let her know that you love her and you want her to know that. And make sure you tell her that too and show it to her. So that kind of finishes up our look at the Song of Songs. I hope you've enjoyed it. And we will come back tomorrow and return to the historical narrative of King Solomon's kingdom and see what happens when he gets a visit from a lady from out of town.